in here closes, it's only on the side, you will hear better. Try and keep the shutter all open so we get a little more ventilation. 2 years ago, when living in England, I heard the name of Charles Tomlinson mentioned frequently by poets and always in a controversial way. After the death of Dylan Thomas and his rhetorical mastery, in the hypocrisy of the post-war mood of growing armaments incredibly powerful and destructive, in the midst of an insane new language coining words such as clean bomb, there came a sharp reaction against the easy language of emotion. Poets and novelists desired a return to the description of objects, an attempt perhaps to restore the purity of people through the purity of things. It was as if writers thought, if we can see clearly enough and directly enough, and not be distracted by the clamor of false provincial traditions, then we can restore a sense of universality and timelessness to art. In this context, I heard Tomlinson's work both attacked and praised by English writers. His important book, Seeing is Believing, with its significant title, had been published first in the United States, and several English poets said that he was too influenced by American poets. They considered him prosaic, too far divorced from the English metrical tradition, too concentrated on a kind of subject matter separated from the English social and economic predicament. Other poets, however, praised him strongly for his awareness of the real values of the poetic tradition and his ability to use the best of it. They considered his poetry striking because of its refusal to compromise, his talent for handling an image with the visual expertness of a painter. What is particularly compelling in Mr. Tomlinson's poetry to me is his power to make us see again, to believe in our vision in a time when our eyes are focused mainly on the TV screen and the advertising billboard. In a recent article on British poetry, Mr. Tomlinson wrote, "One would, in short, be ready to wager that one of the destined themes of future British poetry will be something in the nature of a dialogue with the spirit of the United States. It seems to me that this dialogue must spring from American poets too, and the Poetry Center will do its best to help create it. It's a great pleasure to welcome Mr. Tomlinson to San Francisco State College."
I think I'll begin, ladies and gentlemen, by shedding my coat, if you don't mind. This is the way Allen Ginsberg opens. He doesn't end up with a coat, I assure you, when you're going to further than this. Perhaps the least formal way into the subject would be if I started by telling you something that happened on a former occasion when I gave a public reading at a university which shall remain nameless. The scene I want to relate took place in the annex to the office of the chairman of the English department. I was waiting there to see him before the reading. I was just chatting with his secretary. After a little while, a young lady came in, and we were introduced. She was a poet, the secretary said, and of course I pricked up my ears. One doesn't meet with very many poets, and I wanted to ask her about her subject matter and her craft, and where she published, and had she a book in print, and so forth. We just got as far as the first of these topics, what did she write about, and she probably just got as far as saying the problem of, and suddenly the door opened, and a second young lady entered, looking not very much like the first young lady, but when introductions had occurred, it materialized that she also was a poet. Now, I'd met poets before, but only one at a time, and to have two in the same room at the same moment, both of them of the same sex as Emily Dickinson, was something of a rarity, something of an event. So the first one politely attached herself to the secretary, and the second one politely attached herself to me. And we had a sort of identical conversation. Where did she publish? What was her subject matter? And so forth. And I noticed just then the door opening once more, and in came a young man. I didn't have to ask what he was. It was quite evident from the manuscript book under his arm. And this made me look a little closer, and I saw that the young ladies also had manuscript books under their arms. This went on from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 and so on, up through 10 until we got to about 30, and the room was simply swarming with people with books and manuscripts under their arms. And at first one felt a little Kafkaesque, and then one's eagerness to know whether they had a book in print or whether what their craft was like, one's eagerness evaporated a little. And the answer to the problem was that it was giving in day for their course. They'd all brought their collected verse for submission in creative writing. This was a campus which particularly prided itself on creative writing. Well, it was a little terrifying to see all this poetry around in manuscript, but there was one point of genuine interest in it all. Each time I got as far as asking, "What sort of things do you write about?" several of the people said they wrote about the problem of. Some of them said they wrote about their difficulties. None of them mentioned anything about looking at things. This at first was rather a surprise. Then, as the numbers increased, it really did become a relief to realize that they weren't all overrunning my own little territory, where looking at things, concentrating on things, concentrating on the world of nature, where all this is fairly central. One wonders how far this would be true of the rest of their generation. How far does the universe speak meaningfully to them? How far do they experience visual perception as meaning, as evidence of relationship with a universe that exists in its own right and yet is intelligible to us, an environment where tact and self-containment bring back to us perhaps far more than we can ever give. I tried in a very early poem to formulate tentatively the grounds for this relationship. It's from a book called The Necklace, published rather more years ago than I dare to remember, and the poem has for its title Observation of Facts. Facts have no eyes. One must surprise them as one surprises a tree by regarding its, shall I say, facets of copiousness. The tree stands, the house encloses, the room flowers. These are fact stripped of imagination. Their relation is mutual. A dryad is a sort of chintz curtain between myself and a tree. The tree stands, or does not stand, as I draw or remove the curtain. The house encloses, or fails to signify, as being bodied over against one, as something one has to do with. The room flowers, once one has introduced mental fiber beneath its elegance, a rough pot or two outweighing the persistence of frippery in lampshades or wallpaper. Style speaks what was seen, or it conceals the observation behind the observer, a voice wearing a ruff. Those facets of copiousness which I proposed exist do so when we have silenced ourselves. silence, then, a quietness of the self, is the essential condition of realizing, as Cézanne puts it, one's little sensation. I want silence to be at the center of these poems I'm going to be reading, the silence that one imposes, so to speak, on the imposing self in order to get at the true fact that one is observing. That's the doctrine. Now for a little more evidence, let me read two other poems centered in their different ways on this same mystery of relationship to what we see when we silence ourselves. Two poems on painters, on Cézanne and Van Gogh. They make an antithesis. In Cézanne's paintings, there's a watchful quiet, an uncanny ability to realize the presence of things, to realize in a kind of stillness that is never mere passivity, what he called the immensity, the torrent of the world in a little bit of matter. Here is Cézanne at Aix. Aix, as you know, is where the famous motif Mont Saint-Victoire is. Cézanne at Aix. And the mountain, each day immobile like fruit, unlike also, because irreducible, because neither a component of the delicious and therefore questionable, nor distracted as the sitter by his own pose, and therefore doubly to be questioned. It is not posed, it is, untaught, unalterable, a stone bridgehead to that which is tangible, because unfelt before. There, in its weathered weight, its silence silences, a presence which does not present itself. Now, Van Gogh, on the other hand, or Van Gogh, or Van Hoogh, or however one pronounces it, seems, perhaps, more aggressive before the natural scene, too ready to annex to his needs, to twist its forms into a vehicle for his own feelings, rather than allowing its very there-ness, as with Cézanne, to modify those feelings. Here is Farewell to Van Gogh. The quiet deepens. You will not persuade one leaf of the accomplished, steady, darkening chestnut tower to displace itself with more of violence than the air supplies, when, gathering dusk, the pond brims evenly, and we must be content with stillness. Unhastening, daylight withdraws from us its shapes into their central calm. Stone by stone, your rhetoric is dispersed until the earth becomes once more the earth, the leaves a sharp partition against cooling blue. Farewell, and for your instructive frenzy, gratitude. The world does not end tonight, and the fruit that we shall pick tomorrow await us, weighing the unstripped bough. The ideal of the kind of perceiving I'm getting at comes in a great passage from John Ruskin's splendid autobiography, Praeterita. He's describing an event which took place after a long phase of illness when Ruskin was suffering from suspected tuberculosis. And this happens, this particular passage happens when he's just coming through, when he's returning through convalescence toward a grasp of his full faculties. The passage goes like this. I took out my book and began to draw a little aspen on the other side of the cart road carefully. How I managed to get into that utterly dull cart road when there were sandstone rocks to be sought for, the fates, as I have so often to observe, only know. Languidly, but not idly, I began to draw that small aspen tree. And as I drew, the languor passed away. The beautiful lines insisted on being traced without weariness. More and more beautiful they became as each rose out of the rest and took its place in the air. With wonder increasing every instant, I saw that they composed themselves by finer laws than any known of men. At last, the tree was there, and everything I had thought before about trees, nowhere. That, then, is a possible ideal of vision, a respect for theirness, for that which is other than one thought it was. Ruskin also said, how many people are misled by what has been said and sung of the serenity of the Italian skies, to suppose that they must be more blue than the skies of the north, and think that they see them so, whereas the sky of Italy is far more dull and grey in colour than the skies of the north, and is distinguished only by its intense repose of light. That's from Modern Painters, that unbelievably neglected masterpiece. This is from the early section written in the 1840s. Well, I've quoted both these passages to give just a feel of the background of ideas which supports the kind of poems I'm trying to write. And now I want to read a poem which attempts to put into practice this Ruskinian ideal of perception. It's called Tramontana at Lerici. Now, the tramontana is a very, very cold wind which blows off the mountains. It's relentlessly cold, yet it merely changes the consistency of the atmosphere. The sun doesn't go away. You still have sunlight with it, and yet this incredible, almost moral atmosphere of intense chill. Tramontana at Lerici. Today, should you let fall a glass, it would disintegrate. Played off with such keenness against the cold's resonance, the sounds hard, separate and distinct, dropping away in a diminishing cadence, that you might swear this was the imitation of glass falling. Leaf dapples sharpen. Emboldened by this clarity, the minds of artificers would turn prismatic, running on lace perforated in crisp wafers that could cut like steel. Constitutions drafted under this fecund chill would be annulled for the strictness of their equity, the moderation of their pity. At evening, one is alarmed by such definition, in as many lost greens as one will give glances to recover. As many again which the landscape, absorbing into the steady dusk, condenses from aquamarine to that slow indigo pitch where the light and twilight abandon themselves. And the chill grows. In this air unfit for politicians and romantics, dark hardens from blue, effacing the windows. A tangible block, it will be no accessory to that which does not concern it. One is ignored by so much cold, suspended in so much night. Let me read now a poem about something seen on a much smaller scale, and this one has for its title Paring the Apple. There are portraits and still lives, and there is paring the apple. And then, paring it slowly, from under cool yellow, cold white emerging. And the spring of concentric peel, unwinding off white, the blade hidden, dividing. There are portraits and still lives, and the first, because human, does not excel the second, and neither is less weighted with a human gesture than paring the apple with a human stillness. The cool blade severs between coolness, apple rind compelling a recognition. A respect, then, for the reality outside ourselves, that's something the poet must learn, something that Ezra Pound found lacking, for instance, in W.B. Yeats, in that charming passage in the Pisan Cantos, where Pound complained that Yeats didn't look at architecture properly, he was far too busy symbologizing everything. The passage which goes, "An Uncle William dawdling around Notre Dame in search of whatever, paused to admire the symbol with Notre Dame standing inside it." Well, with the excuse from Pound, I shall move on now from nature to architecture. I often find myself writing poems about architecture, about its relation to setting and people. Architecture, an art which shows itself in such shoddy decline in so much of our present-day urban reconstruction. I don't know what the case is here. I imagine it's probably much the same as it is there, Labba in England, in Bristol, where I teach, where a basically superb city with a marvellous variety of buildings of all kinds, from the Norman era up through the medieval times to the wonderful Regency terraces at the turn of the 18th century. One has all these things, and yet in the urban reconstruction that I've seen over the past 6 or 7 years, one has incredible failures of taste. One feels in the gargantuan heartlessness of the new shopping centres, in the utter stylelessness and architectural cliché of what has gone up, in the marriage of convenience between financial prudence and spiritual incapacity. One feels a terrible symbol of something rotten in the state of contemporary England, and doubtless more than contemporary England. A want of a vital imagination, a complete reliance on the second hand, on what the architectural magazine said. The following poem, "The Crane," was written on catching sight one morning as I drove into work, on catching sight of the immense crane looming up over the cityscape and building the future. "The Crane." That insect without antennae, over its cotton spool lip, letting an almost invisible tenuity of steel cable drop some 70 feet, with the grappling hook hidden also behind a dense foreground among which it is fumbling, and over which, mantis-like, it is begging or threatening, gracile from a clear sky. That paternal, constructive insect without antennae would seem to assure us that the future is safe because it is in my hands, and we do not doubt this veracity. We can only fear it, as many of us as pause here to remark such silent solicitude for lifting intangible weights into real walls. In the past 150 years or so, we seem to have become more and more alienated from our visual surroundings, and what is more, they from us. We don't see them. We don't tell the truth about them. Too many people are forced to live in their tract houses without household gods, without lares. They do not know that laric world, to steal Rilke's marvelous adjective larish, they do not know that laric world whose image lingers in any house, I imagine, built before 1800 and a good many built after it. People inhabit so often today the squalor of moderation, the poverty of utility. Now, the poet who sees, and who can describe what he sees, may perhaps entertain the hope that he can sharpen the visual and more than visual powers of others at a time when, in an age like our own, a sense of quality in style is being lost in the everyday scene, when a beautiful door is not known from an ugly door, when building is shoddy and shoddiness is acceptable. In the English countryside, past and present too often meet in the image of a shattered unity against which all one's creative instincts rebel, explode into anger. I think particularly of a beautiful old farmhouse called the Hall Farm at Stowey, where through the centuries, each century has added its own bit to the farm, has probably torn something down, has replaced something, and yet has managed, despite that, has managed to build up into some kind of unity. But our own century seems to be incapable of this tactful relationship with the artifacts of the past. That's Bougainvillea. They only grow in poets' books, you know. On the Hall at Stowey. Walking by map, I chose unwonted ground, a crooked, questionable path which led beyond the margin, then delivered me at a turn. Red marl had rutted the aimless track that firmly withheld the recompense it hid, till now, close by its end, the day's discoveries began with the dimming night. A house, the wall stones brown, the doubtful light, more of a mist than light, floating at hedge height through the sodden fields, had yielded, or a final glare burst there rather, to concentrate sharp saffron, as the ebbing year, or so it seemed, for the dye deepened, poured all of its yellow strength through the way I went. Over grass, garden space, over the grange that jutted beyond, lengthening down the house line, tall as it was, by tying it to the earth, trying its pride, which submitted, under a nest of barns, a walled weight of lesser encumbrances, few of which worsened it, and none as the iron sheds sealing my own approach. All stone, I had passed these last unwarrantable symbols of, no, let me define rather the thing they were not, all that we cannot be, by the description simply of that which merits it, stone. Why must, as it does at each turn, each day, the mean robbers of patience distract us before even its opposite, before stone, which cut, piled, mortared, is patience's presence. The land farmed, the house was neglected, but gashed panes, and there were many, still showed into the pride of that presence. I had reached unchallenged within feet of the door, ill-painted, but at no distant date, the least our prodigal time could grudge it, paused to measure the love, to assess its object, that trusts for continuance to the mason's hand. 5 centuries here were at the least 5, in linked love, eager excrescence, where the door, arched, crowned with acanthus, aimed at a civil elegance, but hit this sturdier compromise, neither Greek, Gothic, nor strawberry, clumped from the arching point, and swathing down like a fist of wheat, the unconscious emblem for the house's worth. Conclusion surrounded it, and the accumulation after Lammas growth. Still coming on, heart's tongue by maidenhair thickened beneath the hedges, the corn levelled and carried long since. But the earth, its tint glowed in the house wall, out of the reddish dark still thrust up foison through the browning back of the exhausted year. Thrust through the unweeded yard where earth and house debated the terrain. My eye caught in those flags a gravestone's fragment set by a careful century. The washed inscription, still keen, showed only a fragile stem, a stave, a broken circlet, as, unintelligibly clear, craft in the sharp decrepitude, a pothook grooved its firm memorial. Within, wet from the failing roof, walls greened. each hearth refitted for a suburban whim. Each room denied what it was, diminished thus to a barbarous mean, had comforted, but for a time, its latest tenant. Angered, I turned to my path through the inhuman light, light that a fish might swim, stained by the grayness of the smoking fields. 5 centuries, and we, what we had not made ugly, we had laid waste, left, I should say, the office to nature, whose blind battery, best fitted to perform it, outdoes us, completes by persistence all that our negligence fails in. Saddened, yet angered beyond sadness, where the road doubled upon itself, I halted for a moment, facing the empty house and its laden barns. The hall at Stowey is a provincial building, but provincial when provinciality still carried a live current of culture. Provinciality of a different kind, also covered by the image of architecture, comes in a poem I shall read in a moment, called More Foreign Cities. Now, Matthew Arnold, as you all know, once spoke of that powerful, but at present somewhat narrow-toned organ, the modern Englishman. One seems to catch that tone, the tone of the organ, not of Arnold, alas, one seems to catch that tone in one of the English poetic manifestos of the 1950s, which ran as follows. Nobody wants any more poems on the grander themes for a few years. At the same time, nobody wants any more poems about philosophers or paintings or novelists or art galleries or mythology or foreign cities or other poems. I'm not saying who wrote this, I'm merely quoting it as evidence. With this bit of prose in mind, one really can get a feel of this phase of our poetry represented by a kind of unquestioning Philistinism, a kind of self-congratulatory lucky jimmery. I'm not mentioning the author of the passage, which was a very peculiar, very odd phase in English poetry. The watch cry was moderation, which meant largely playing the unashamed middle brow. It also meant that very low-pressured talents didn't need to turn up the gas. Only recently, I was looking over the pages of D.J. Enright's Poets of the 1950s and reading the various bits of comments by way of manifesto that the various poets had contributed to this book. And really, one did wonder what the great spirits, what would Yeats or Pasternak or Rilke are made of this endless decrescendo of middling intentions. It was quite unspeakable. One was really back with George Eliot's novel, with Mr. Casaubon, when he determined to abandon himself to the stream of feeling and was surprised to find what an exceedingly shallow rill it was. The difference, however, and I think we ought to be fair to Mr. Casaubon in this, the difference was that Mr. Casaubon did try to abandon himself, whereas the boys in the 50s, they said, oh, shallow rills, that's just the place, that's where you net poetry, this is the place to go if you want to write. That's a digression. To come back now to the poem, heralded by the piece of prose I read to you, this poem, More Foreign Cities, isn't altogether serious. It's merely a verbal reconstruction, I suppose, of the kind of thing you get in a painting, I should imagine, by Paul Klee. Paul Klee would be a good example of the kind of thing that is done in visual art on these lines, this kind of fantasy. More Foreign Cities. Quote, nobody wants any more poems about foreign cities. Not forgetting Kojen, that musical city. It has few buildings and annexes space by combating silence. There is Fiordiligi. Its sun changes against walls of transparent stone, unsettling all preconception. A city for architects. They are taught by casting their nets into those moving shoals. And there is Kairouan, whose lit space so slides into and fits the stone masses, one would doubt which was the more solid, unless folding back gold segments out of the white pith globe of a quartered orange, one may learn, perhaps, to read such perspectives. At Luna, there is a city of bridges, where even the inhabitants are mindful of a shared privilege. A bridge does not exist for its own sake. It commands vacancy. I should like now to draw toward the latter part of this reading with examples from more recent groups of work. So far I've been reading from The Necklace, 1955, and also from Seeing is Believing, the last volume of original poems. The one I want to go on to now will be coming out at the end of August and has for its title A Peopled Landscape. But don't worry, the commercial will go off in a moment and we'll get back to the program, but just to give you an idea of these things. The poems which I've been writing of late, in fact, do seem to be just that. They seem to be more people. The landscape seems to have more characters in it. Two of the groups I want to read come from two places. The first, from the English industrial Midlands, Stoke-on-Trent, where the author was born. And the second lot come from the more rural southwest of England, where he now lives. Stoke-on-Trent, as you probably know, is the place where most of the world's pots come from, cups and saucers and so on. Wedgwood, the famous potter, established his factory there way back in the 18th century. Beside this, you've also got coal and steel. And all this does produce a rather grim landscape. Arnold Bennett describes it very well in his novel The Old Wives' Tale, which some of you may have read. He says, for the production of pottery, its atmosphere, it's the atmosphere of the Stoke-on-Trent area, the pottery's area, its atmosphere is as black as its mud. For this, it burns and smokes all night, so that it has been compared to hell. The accent, by the way, the potter's accent, where you can still find it at its most barbed and barbaric, sounds, I always think, much more savagely stoical than the other English northern accents. The test case one always tries on people to see if they can understand this accent goes like this. Caustic a burg in woe, not yet till it busts. Which said more slowly, sounds like this. Caustic a burg again in woe, and not it would yet till it busts. Which being translated into Her Majesty's English simply means, can you kick a ball against a wall and knock it with your head until it bursts? If you've seen the landscape, if you've seen the urban setting, I think you can realize why people have almost been challenged into this explosion of consonants. It's the only way of having a point of view. Before I put the people in the landscape, I'll start by giving you a description of what it looks like. There are a lot of canals running through Stoke-on-Trent, through the pottery's area. Some people call it the Venice of the North, though I've always felt this has been slightly exaggerated. There are a lot of canals at all events. The poem is called Canal. Swans. I watch them come unsteadying, the dusty, green, and curving arm of water. Sinuously, both the live bird and the bird the water bends into a white and wandering reflection of itself, go by in grace, a world of objects. Symmetrically punched, now empty rivet holes betray a sleeper fence. Below its raggedness, the waters darken, and above it rear the saw-toothed houses, which the swinging of the waters makes scarcely less regular in repetition. Swans are backed by these, as these are by a sky of silhouettes, all black and almost all indefinite. A whitish smoke in drifting diagonals, accents, divides the predominance of street and chimney lines, where all is either mathematically supine or vertical, except the pyramids of slag. And there, unseen among such angularities, a church, a black freestanding witness that a space of graves invisibly is also there. Only its clock identifies the tower between the accompaniment of stacks, where everything repeats itself, the slag, the streets, and water that repeats them all again and spreads them rippling out beneath the eye of the discriminating swans that seek for something else, and the blank brink concludes them without conclusion. Now for the people in the scene. I've taken someone called John Maydew, good old Staffordshire name, who began life, this is based on an actual man, who began life as a bailiff on one of the big English country estates, then was driven into the potteries to seek a livelihood when, with taxation and whatnot, the estates began to close down after the First World War. Like so many English working class people in industrial areas, he's an avid gardener. And his garden, his allotment, as they call them, his allotment where he finds some fulfillment in his work and where he feeds the toads on worms, his allotment is a kind of precarious Eden and a very necessary one. Here, then, is John Maydew, or The Allotment. Ranges of clinker heaps go orange now. Through cooler air, an acrid drift seeps upwards from the valley mills. The spoiled and staled distances invade these closer comities of vegetable shade, glass houses, rows and trellises of redly flowering beans. This is a paradise where you may smell the cinders of quotidian hell beneath you. Here grow their green reprieves for those who labor, linger in their watch-chained waistcoats, rolled-back sleeves, the ineradicable peasant in the dispossessed and half-tamed Englishman. By day he makes a burrow of necessity, from which, at evening, he emerges here. A thoughtful yet unthinking man, John Maydew. Memory stagnates in you and breeds a bitterness. It grew and rooted in your silence from the day you came unwitting out of war, in all the pride of ribbons and a scar, to 40 years of mean amends. He squats within his shadow, and a toad that takes into a slack and twitching jaw the worms he proffers it looks up at him through eyes that are as dimly faithless as the going years. For once returned, he found that he must choose between an England profitlessly green and this, a seamed and lunar grey, where slag in lava folds unrolls beneath him. The valley gazes up through kindling eyes. As unregarded at his back, its hollows deepen with the black extending shadows, and the sounds of day explore its coming cavities, the night's refreshed recesses. Tomorrow he must feed its will. His interrupted pastoral take heart into those close and gritty certainties that lie a glowing ruse, all washed in hesitations now. He eyes the toad, beating in the assuagement of his truce. To turn now to a very different setting, the setting of the English Southwest, the land lying from the Cotswolds down through Somerset. One of the constant experiences here in this area is the sense of the continuity of architecture and setting. For example, in a church near to us at a place called Daglingworth. In the north wall of the church there's a tiny block of stone. It contains a very, very small window. Now this very, very small window was once upon a time, before it was moved around about the 14th century, it was the east window of the Saxon church. If you look at it even more closely, you see it bears an inscription in Latin, a dedication to the mother goddess and the spirit of place. And it also bears the name Flavia, and it's speculated that Flavia was in fact the name of the Roman matron of the villa in that particular valley. So it's this sense of continuity which is so marvelous about the English Southwest, an ineradicable spirit of place, a land of limestone, that humanistic rock, as Adrian Stokes calls it. In the following poem, the picture of JT in a prospect of stone, you must imagine a small girl, about 4 years of age, who's been brought up in this setting, emerging through a sheep stile onto the village green. Of course, the title is borrowed, stolen, whatever you want to say, from Andrew Marvell's wonderful poem, The Picture of T.C. in a Prospect of Flowers. It is a kind of dialogue. Two voices are speaking in this. The picture of J.T. in a prospect of stone. What should one wish a child, and that one's own? Emerging from between the stone lips of a sheep stile that divides village graves and village green. Wish her the constancy of stone. But stone is hard. Say rather it resists the slow corrosives and the flight of time, and yet it takes the play, the fluency from light. How would you know the gift you'd give was the gift she'd wish to have? Gift is giving, gift is meaning. First I give, then let her live with it to prove its quality the better, and thus learn to love what, to begin with, she might spurn. You'd moralize a gift. I'd have her understand the gift I gave her. And so she shall, but let her play her innocence away, emerging, as she does, between her doom unknown, her unmown green. Last of all in this group, a somewhat longer piece about a return to a West Country village where I lived for several years, and about the relationships in this village. Perhaps I ought to tell you the address we used to have at this place. It goes like this, and it's really poem in itself. It goes, the old rectory, Hinton Blewett, Temple Cloud, Somerset. Since then, I've fallen from Eden, and I live now at Brook Cottage, Oselworth, Bywood-on-Andred, Gloucestershire. I don't feel that's quite as platonic and untarnished as Hinton Blewett. Anyway, this poem was written on returning from 6 months in the United States and going to see a farming household whom I knew very well, and on arriving, discovering that the head of the household, the father, had been killed 3 weeks before on his tractor. What struck one in the attitude, and the words of the wife particularly, what struck one was the way in which her religion, these people were very devout, the way in which her religion had made a breakwater, as it were, for an experience which, after all, is so unanswerable. This, then, is the poem, Return to Hinton, written on the author's return to Hinton Blewett from the United States. 10 years, and will you be a footnote merely, England of the Bible, open at Genesis on the parlor table. God saw the light, that it was good. It falls athwart the book through window lace, whose shadow decorates the sheets of the bridal march, a square of white above a keyboard and below a text which is a prayer. The television box is one. The mullions and flagged floor of the kitchen through an open door witness a second world in which, beside the hob, the enormous kettle's blackened bellies ride as much the tokens of an order as the burnished brass. You live between the two, and ballasted against the merely new, the tide and shift of time, you wear your widow's silk, your hair plaited as it has been throughout those years whose rhyme it bears. A tractor mounts the ramp of stones into the yard. A son surveys the scenes that occupied a father's days. Proud of his machine, will he transmit that more than bread that leaves you undisquieted? This house is poorer by a death than last I saw it. Yet who may judge as poverty that sadness without bitterness, those sudden tears that your composure clears, admonishes? Your qualities are like the land, inherited, but you have earned your right to them, have given grief its due, and on despair have closed your door as the gravestones tell you to. Speak your composure, and you share the accent of their rhymes. Express one readiness in a worn dress of chapel gospel. Death's not the enemy of you nor of your kind. A surer death creeps after me out of that generous, rich, and nervous land where, buried by the soft oppression of prosperity, locality's mere grist to build the even bed of roads that will not rest until they lead into a common future, rational and secure, that we must speed by means that are not either. Narrow your farm-bred certainties I do not hold. I share your certain enemy. For we who write the verse you do not read, already plead your cause before that cold tribunal, while you're unaware they hold their session. Our language is our land that we'll not waste or sell against a promised mess of pottage that we may not taste. For who has known the season's sweet succession and would still exchange them for a whim, a wish, or swim into a mill race for an unglimpsed fish? I shall draw towards an end with one or two things rather different from what I've been reading so far. First of all, a piece which is a work of translation from the Spanish of Antonio Machado. It does seem that when we think of Spanish poetry, Lorca is the first name that comes to mind. Machado strikes me as being a much more solid kind of writer than Lorca. Perhaps this is unfair. Lorca, after all, did die in his mid-30s. Machado lasted on until the age of 64. However, there is a quality, I think, of wit, a quality of stoicism, a quality of humor, which is very characteristically Machado's own. The poem I want to read is a translation, or rather a version, I should say, of Machado's Lament on the Virtues and Verses on Account of the Death of Don Guido. It was pneumonia finally carried away Don Guido, and so the bells, din dan, toll for him the whole day. Died Don Guido, gentlemen, when younger, great at gallantry and roistering, a minor talent in the bull ring, older his prayers grew longer. The civilian gentleman kept, so they say, a seraglio, was apt at managing a horse and a master at cooling Manzanilla. When his riches dwindled, it was his obsession to think that he ought to think of settling in quiet possession. And he settled in a very Spanish way, which was to marry a maiden of large fortunes and to repaint his blazons, to refer to the traditions of this house of ours, setting a measure to scandals and amours and damping down the expenditure on pleasure. He became, great pagan that he was, brother in a fraternity. On Holy Thursday could be seen, disguised, the immense candle in his hand in the long robe of a Nazarene. Today you may hear the bell say that the good Don Guido, with solemn face, tomorrow must go the slow road to the burial place. Forever and for always gone, good Don Guido. What have you left, some will say. I ask, what have you taken to the world in which you are today? Your love for braid and for silks and gold, and the blood of bulls and the fume that rolled from off the altars. To good Don Guido and his equipage, bon voyage. The here and the there, cavalier, show in your withered face, confess the infinite, the nothingness. Oh, the thin cheeks yellow, and the eyelids wax, and the delicate skull on the bed's pillow. Oh, end of an aristocracy, the beard on breast lies limp and hoary. In the rough serge of a monk he's dressed, crossed the hands that cannot stir, and the Andalusian gentleman on his best behavior. That's Don Guido. And finally, a couple of pieces written since getting to the States. I am suffering badly from cultural indigestion, having been living in New Mexico and attending Indian dances there, just having been to Old Mexico, translating Spanish poetry, lecturing on William Blake. It does become rather difficult to keep it all clear. But I have recently had the chance, had the time to write one or two new things which do concern towns and places and landscapes in the States. The first one is called Freudian error. The first one is called At Barstow. Some of you may know Barstow. I hoped when I came out, I looked it up in the Atlas, and I was hoping it was in Nevada. But I'm afraid it's not, ladies and gentlemen. It is, in fact, in California. Only just. At Barstow. Nervy with neons, the main drag was all there was. A placeless place, a faint flavor of Mexico in the tacos, tasting of gasoline. Trucks refueled before taking off through space. Someone lived in the houses with their house yards wired like tiny Belsons. The Götterdämmerung would be like this. No funeral pyres, no choirs of lost trombones. An Untergang without a clang, without a glimmer of gone glory, however dimmed. At the motel desk was a photograph of Roy Rogers, signed. It was here he made a stay. He did not ride away on trigger through the high night, the tilted Pleiades overhead, the pole star low. No going off until the eyes of beer cans had ceased to glint at him and the desert darknesses had quenched the neons. He was spent. He was content. Down he lay. The passing trucks patrolled his sleep. The shifted gears contrived a muffled fugue against the fading of his day. And his dustless, undishonored Stetson rode beside the bed, glowed in the pulsating, never-final twilight there at that execrable conjunction of gasoline and desert air. Finally, a poem called Mr. Brodsky. Mr. Brodsky is a neighbor of ours with a certain enthusiasm, which you'll find out about when we get to the poem. If I tell you Mila lives round the corner, you will see the difficulties of living round the corner from such a character. This will be the last poem I shall be reading. Mr. Brodsky. I had heard before of an American who would have preferred to be an Indian, but not until Mr. Brodsky, of one whose professed and long pondered on passion was to become a Scot, who even sent for haggis and oatcakes across continent. Having read him, in Cambridge English, a verse or two from Macdermot, I was invited to repeat the reading before a Burns night gathering where the Balmoral Pipers of Albuquerque would play in the haggis out of its New York tin. Of course, I said, no, I could not go, and then half regretted I had not been. But to console and cure the wish came Mr. Brodsky, bringing his pipes, and played until the immense distended bladder of leather seemed it could barely contain its water. Tears, idle tears, for the bridal of Annie Laurie and Morton J. Brodsky. A bagpipe in a dwelling is a resonant instrument. And there he stood, lost in the gorse, the heather, or whatever, 6,000 miles and more from the infection's source, in our neo-New Mexican parlor, where I had heard before of an American who would have preferred to be merely an Indian. Thank you. Well, that's the work.